Happy Saturday. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. How is everybody today? You know, I have kind of an interesting show for you today. And I'll tell you why. I've gotten some great feedback, by the way, on the last six or seven shows. I'm glad you folks are liking them. I'm glad you are connecting the never-ending array and pattern of dots. And I'm glad you're finding the information I'm bringing you, as one reader wrote, extremely interesting, not something I've heard before, and have not been able to find virtually anywhere else. Kudos to you. Thank you. I appreciate that. That's my job on this show, to forecast, to bring you news that nobody else is bringing you, that affects your lives, your children's lives, your freedoms, your pocketbook, your property, and your rights. And today, I'm down at the United States Air Force Base in Mountain Home, Idaho. Kind of a cool base. Was signing books down here, you know, with fighter planes roaring overhead and the PX shaking. I mean, it's really pretty cool. And they mark the times, particularly 4 o'clock, which I guess is kind of the end of the day, end of the shift, with bugles. You know, the standard military theme and music. And then at the 4 o'clock bugle, they play the national anthem after the bugle call. And it kind of blares out in raspy tones from the loudspeaker, I guess from the headquarters building or administration building, across the entire sprawling complex of this Air Force base against a backdrop of roaring jet engines and screeching brakes. It's really kind of cool. And I had this really interesting experience today. It's after the book signing, which was terrific. Thank you, all you folks down in Mountain Home, Idaho, and surrounding areas for coming in. We sold out. And in fact, my book signing was over early. And I'm sitting outside. There's a little bench kind of nicely done outside the hotel, which is called the Air Force Inn. Put me up in a really nice little, I guess, semi-suite. And I noticed that when the national anthem, I had the cell phone in my hand. I was talking to somebody, I forget who it was. And I heard the national anthem, and it kind of pleased me to hear it. You know, but I was focused on my conversation. And I looked up, and two men had come out of the hotel lobby. And they were dressed casually, shorts, you know, t-shirts. Pretty well-built guys, probably 40 years old in that neighborhood. Shortly cropped hair, you know, definitely military or military leaning. And both of them faced the music and stood at attention and put their hands over their hearts. I mean, right out there in front of the hotel, and they had walked out of the lobby specifically to do that, quite obviously. And here I was standing there, paying attention to the anthem, but talking on the phone. And you know, I was suddenly ashamed. Ashamed. And I told the caller, I will call you right back. And I hung up the phone and slipped it into my jeans pocket and stood at attention with my hand over my heart. And, you know, it's little moments like that. You'll probably see that moment in one of my books sometime, perhaps embellished. But it's little moments like that that give you a perspective. It's a tiny little act by one man, two men, you know, in the middle of a big Air Force base, in the center of a huge sprawling country, you know, a pimple on a duck's butt sitting on an elephant's back, on a spinning universe, right? It's just not a leaf in a tree moved because these two men came out and stood at attention with their hands over their hearts. And it got me to thinking about this nation and how we are in decline. And you know, my radio shows talk about all the problems. They warn you about this and that, and they bring to your attention X, Y, and Z, which I don't know about you, but curls my hair. I mean, listen to the last six or seven shows. But through it all, I hope I impart a sense of optimism. You know, I think we, the folks who value American values, the folks who value the Constitution, the rule of law, who want to see our children and our children's children have a better life and are not living simply for ourselves and for today, I think we're going to win. I just think it's going to be ugly between now and then. And I think in the end, America is going to prevail on a global basis, but it's going to be ugly between now and then. We got some very hard, tough times coming, which is why I have the family safety set of articles, which I run every week for you. And hopefully you read and paste some very good ideas in those. Anyway, I thought about it as I sat there. I didn't call the person back I'd been talking to. Instead, I was kind of lost in thought over this tiny little scene that meant so much that I had just witnessed. And that guiltily, in putting down my cell phone and putting my hand over my heart, I had become part of. And it occurred to me that America's decline is caused by a lack of information. You know, information is the first line of defense. You cannot make a good decision unless you are informed. Period. Whether it's about your country, about your vote, about your business, about your family, about your friends, about your marriage, I don't care what it is. If you don't have the right information, making the right decision is probably not going to be right. It's not going to happen. And I realized, yes, you know, Barack Obama is a Muslim sympathizer. He is a progressive, spelled communist. He is obviously, you know, a pathological liar who believes that the means justifies the end, who really couldn't care less about the American people. And so are some of the Republicans, all of his progressive buddies, and of course Hillary Clinton. I mean, go back and listen to my show here a week or two ago, two sides of the same tarnished coin. Barack Obama barreling down the highway of anti-Americanism, America undermining because of his ideology and his narcissism, and Hillary Clinton barreling down the same highway, maybe even faster, we're going to talk about that in a minute, because of her lust for power and greed. And it came to me, and I've talked about it before, that, you know, you can trace the decline of America, the current decline, and I think long-term but temporary in the end, long-term decline of America, to a lack of information, a lack of knowledge, which is a very dangerous thing. You know, in college, I did a double major, one of which was technical journalism and forestry, actually. How's that for a dichotomy? And my technical journalism training, I'll never forget a couple of courses which my 101 journalism teacher, one of the best I had all through college, taught us. The very first day of journalism school, he had us sit in a circle. I think there were 12 or 13 kids in the class. And at that time, CSU was still ranked very high for journalism. At that time, it was actually one of the top 10 schools in the country, which a lot of people don't know. It's one of the reasons I chose it. It was also obviously close to home, and There was no way I was going to take the scholarship I had been offered at Yale after flying back there and seeing those blue blood folks and having to live in the East. That weren't going to happen to the cowboy. No way. But we're sitting in a circle. This maybe the first day, maybe the first week. It was very early in the class. And my professor whispered in the ear of somebody in the circle a slight story, just a short story. And the words that he whispered in the ear that nobody else could hear were, "The young co-ed took her dog for a walk under the full moon in the park." It was that simple. And then he had each person in the circle whisper the words of the story to the next person. And you know, by the time it got to the last person in the class, the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, whatever it was, do you know what that story was? The young woman was raped by a gang of thugs, and then her battered body was chewed on by wild dogs in the park. I mean, it was very close to that. You get the idea. Every set of ears and every mind that those words sifted through from the time they were first uttered by the professor until the time they got to the last student were heard differently, perceived differently, twisted differently, and then communicated with those twists and perceptions based on that person's feelings and background and who knows what in their lives, until you came out with a truly nice, smiley story, and it turned into a disastrous, ugly, nasty story. And I remember another great lesson that this same professor later in the year taught us. We're all sitting in class, the 12 or 13 of us, and he says, take out your notebooks. He had us carry notebooks so that we could jot down things for stories and stuff. We took out our notebooks. He goes, "Here's what I want you to do." And he got up to the blackboard. Yeah, it was still blackboards then. He got up to the blackboard and he wrote five sets of facts. And it happened to be on a story on the Vietnam War at that time. He said, "I want you to take these five facts and I want you to write a story that will leave a reader feeling three different ways: that the war is bad, that the war is good, or that the North Vietnamese are the folks that are in the right." I'm summarizing now. And he called this class story construction. It was how to take the same set of facts and twist them to induce the person who is receiving your communication to believe or think one way or the other. I never forgot that class because it was very easy to do once you really kind of focused on it. And this all ties in, believe it or not, and I'm going to be talking about a couple of things today. I'm way into the show to give you the introduction, but I have something tremendous to read to you which ties into this matter about the press and information which I'm talking about now, and to bring to light both the Israeli you've heard about and the English elections, which bad press tried to influence unsuccessfully, and what I think that means on a much bigger picture for more conservative values everywhere in the world going forward. And then I have a really interesting thing to tell you within that context about regulations, because it fits perfectly. What regulations have really done to this country, there's been several studies out right now, and you know, most of our liberal friends in the press, besides twisting stories, i.e. story construction, and altering stories, i.e. the whispered communications between the 12 of us sitting there in the grass that first day of journalism school. These people who we entrust to bring us the facts so that we can make a decision, and instead, like George Stephanopoulos, not only try and twist the story to create an outcome, but are actually invested, in his case to the tune of $75,000, in the subject of his story. Wow. No wonder these people, these progressives, these liars, these cheats, these ideologues, these narcissistic anti-Americans get elected. No wonder. A scary thing. And it all leads me to believe that I think a large percentage of America's current predicament can be tracked back to an irresponsible press who is more concerned with promoting an ideological twist than it is to bringing you the facts. I don't know whether that's because they don't trust you if they bring you the facts, or because it's kind of a backhanded respect. They know what you'll think if they do bring you the facts. Think about that. You know, the press tried to drum up this, the press in Israel, you know, there's some liberal press in Israel too, and the liberal press here for sure, drummed up this whole thing about Netanyahu was going to lose, and he was a warmonger, and he was this, and he was that, and this is a fait accompli. And of course, we learned that Barry has his operatives over there, and illegally Barry and Hillary are funneling money through the State Department. Hillary wasn't there at the time, but Hillary set it up. That'll come to you in another story I'll bring to you sometime. So all these progressives, and the, you know, these progressives who can't say the words radical jihad, all these people were engaged in an attempt really to have a coup, right? Isn't that what it is? It's a coup. We were trying to have a coup in the capital of one of our closest allies. Very interesting. And the press was thoroughly embarrassed, as was Obama and his minions, when Bibi Netanyahu pulled off not only a victory, but the biggest victory the Likud party, the conservative party, has had in, you know, a long, long time. And the same thing happened in England. I don't know if you were paying attention. It was hardly covered, you know. I mean, talking about a conservative victory in the American press, oh my God, we wouldn't want to do that. But, you know, Cameron, the prime minister over there, and look, he's a liberal guy, but he's conservative relative to the rest of English politics. And he was supposed to get trounced by the socialist, who was really quite a very strong, you know, he was a strong candidate, spoke well. I listened to several of his speeches on YouTube and video. And, you know, Cameron took kind of a page out of the, shall we say, the press's propensity to twist the words. And he successfully portrayed the Conservative Party over there as conservatives being for the working people. Now, think of the nuance of that word. It's really fascinating. And it tells you what the other side does in trying to twist your mind, too. Now, I happen to think Cameron was sincere in his use of this. I just think it was a brilliant, shall we say, play on words, to use a cliche. And for those of you who are drifting a little bit, stick with me, because you're going to get this. You remember back in my show, it was 2-3 months ago, you can find it in the archives quite easy, about what makes Obama tick and what he really thinks. And I talked to you about his book, which told you what he was going to do. It was, you know, it was Obama's Mein Kampf. And his dreams from my father. Not of, not to, not for, but from my father. Which would lead any sane person to say, what did his father think that Barry wants to continue on with? In which case you would have known exactly what Barry was going to do and is doing. But in this case, David Cameron took the words and said, conservatives are for working people. Now think about all the populist nonsense going on. The terms middle class, the terms the workers, meaning employees, that kind of people. You know, using the term the working people automatically made people who work for a living, which in England is like here, 50%, the other 50% being other than those who are truly disabled, let's face it, lazy sops who are on the dole and whose middle name is gimme, gimme, give me, right? And who don't pay taxes. They live completely like leeches. As I think one of the articles I posted a couple months ago by Bill Bonner, who's terrific, the zombies, the legions of zombies, the blood-sucking zombies, he calls them. How true. And you know, as a working guy, and I think many of you who are listening to me, maybe not all, are working people, I really resent that. I'm not happy that people are leeching off my work. I'm pissed that I put in 18 or 19 hours a day so that somebody else can sit on their fat duff, go down the mailbox and get their welfare card, and then go down and buy beer with it at the local grocery store, and then go home and procreate so they can raise the next generation of give-me's or blood-sucking zombies, as Bonner would call them. By the way, he's a hell of an economist. But the term working people, that means this guy's out for all of us who are working. It was very brilliant. And you know, here's what's great. Despite all the BS by the press, the twists, the construction of the story, you know, those two examples I gave you from my journalism school, Cameron's party pulled off a huge victory. It's like Netanyahu in Israel, in England. They trounced the other side that was supposed to win. I mean, it wasn't even close. And all that gives me hope. It gives me hope because it tells me that there's still enough people out there, whether it's England or Israel, and I believe the United States, who can see through the nonsense, who can understand the true reflection of the mirror, who can parse the clever and perverted attempts to twist ideas, direct thought, unreport, as in the case of Hillary Clinton. I mean, really? Hillary Clinton has gone 5 weeks without answering or being asked. And listen, in the press's defense in this, she's running away from them. But, you know, let's face it. The press covers her buying a pizza, right? Or whatever she bought in that little shop. I mean, that whole farce. But the press can't get close to her to ask a question about Benghazi, her tenure at Secretary of State, what happened in Libya, why did Yemen fall apart, why was Chris Stevens killed, was there something else going on there, her foundation, her server wiped clean, her deleted emails, her $30 million income last year, where she gets her money, why she didn't report her. I mean, listen, the list is endless. Her list is as endless as Barry's list are, although they're different lists. Same result. Two sides of a tarnished coin. But the press is only too eager to jump on the guy who wrote the book that exposed Hillary's, I think the guy's a patriot, who exposed Hillary's foundations, including that was Stephanopoulos, who has contributed $75,000 to the Clinton Foundation. That's unbelievable. As somebody trained in journalism, it makes my skin crawl, to be honest with you. It would be like your attorney in a lawsuit. It really is this bad. Your attorney in a lawsuit not telling you that he was taking money from the person who was suing you or that you were suing. I mean, it's really that bad. Can you imagine that? All of you out there who are listening to me who've had a divorce, and I hope it's very few, can you imagine if you found out that the attorney who represented you in your divorce was taking or giving money to your wife or your husband who you were divorcing while he was representing you in court? Would you be happy? I don't think so. But that's what the press does. Stephanopoulos is just an example. You know, he's not the problem. He is a symptom of the problem. And until we get a press who once again stands up for journalistic ethics, who understands their fundamental role in this republic, and takes seriously their absolute duty, their duty on their honor to bring the public true and correct information. And of course to be free to voice an opinion, but to label it as opinion. That's a separate article. It doesn't go in a news article. Until that happens, many people are going to remain uninformed. They're not going to have the knowledge, which is A, the ability to make a good decision, and B, the ability to defend themselves against bad decisions. Did you know that in this whole uproar over the last few weeks over Hillary's stuff, the press seeming not to say much other than Fox and a few other outlets about not being able to ask Hillary a question about anything tangible instead of reporting on her pizza, you know, with news of the Kardashians but no news of the British election? I mean, it's really unbelievable. There was a little-known article that came out that the progressives definitely don't want you to hear about. This is a perfect example of really important news either not being reported or being put back on page 92. And on page 1 is a story of, you know, actor XYZ's ulcer. So John Dawson and John Cedar are two terrific economists, two of the most respected economists in the world. And they did a study on the effect of government regulation on the U.S. economy and economic growth, which they just got done with. Not reported at all. Did you know that over the last half century, and they termed it, by the way, negative and substantial, that's a quote, federal regulations added over the past 50 years, in other words, the increase in federal regulations, have reduced real output growth. That means the growth of our country, the growth of our economy, the growth of our incomes, the growth of our children's children's future, has reduced real output growth by about 2 percentage points on average each year over the period 1949 to 2005. I want you to think about the cumulative effect of 2% over 50 years. Let me put that in context for you to look dig deeper in their study, which nobody covered. That reduction, I'm quoting, that reduction in the growth rate has led to an accumulated reduction in GDP. Everybody knows what that is, if you've been listening to me at all. In GDP of about $38.8 trillion, I'm adding the emphasis, as of the end of 2011. Folks, $40 trillion we've spent simply trying to abide by regulations which were promulgated beginning 50 years ago. I want you to think about that number. Let's put it in context. If GDP at the end of 2011 would have been without these regulations, let me start over. Without these regulations, GDP at the end of 2011 would have been $53.9 trillion per year instead of what it is now, $15.1 trillion. I want you to think about that difference in this economy. $53.9 trillion in 1 year versus $15.1 trillion. Wow, you talk about an economy that would have been on fire with not enough people to fill the jobs, people getting all sorts of good money for their work. Home ownership, but it's, look, we can go down the list. Just the opposite of what's going on now. Yet all these people continue to cry for new laws, new regulations, this, that, and the other. It's time to tell your Congress people to stop. Not only to stop, but to dismantle these regulations. Don't wait for this press to tell you about this stuff. It's not going to happen. Most of the press are in favor of regulations. They don't give a damn about the GDP. They figure Friday is payday, and payday is always going to come, and it's their duty, using whatever means they can, to twist your mind, deprive you of knowledge, and make you act, vote, or whatever, and with the way they, as the elitists they are, think you ought to, for the kumbaya land they want to America to be. Those are staggering numbers, folks. And we allowed it to happen. I'm going to read you something here to close this show out. It's really, I've been saving it because it's terrific. And this is some more history for you. And it kind of ties in my opinion, to those two men that I don't know from Adam coming outside the hotel lobby on a U.S. Air Force base to hold their hands over their hearts and stand at attention while the anthem was played. And which ties into where we are as a country, which ties into the reason being lack of information, twisting of information, construction of the story, which leads us to the results. I gave you one that isn't being reported, which is affecting your income by, you know, just take your income, folks. If the GDP was three times bigger than it is now, maybe your income wouldn't be three times bigger. I guarantee it'd be double. It really does have an effect on each and every one of us in many different ways other than income. So after our discussions today, I want you to think about what I'm going to read you. In 1887, Alexander Tyler, a Scottish history professor at the University of Edinburgh, had this to say about the fall of the Athenian Republic some 2,000 years prior. Quote, "A democracy is always temporary in nature. It simply cannot exist as a permanent form of government. A democracy will continue to exist up until the time that voters discover they can vote themselves general gifts from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates who promise the most benefits from the public treasury. with the result that every democracy will finally collapse over loose fiscal policy, which is always followed by a dictatorship, unquote. He continues, the average age of the world's greatest civilizations from the beginning of history has been about 200 years. During those 200 years, these nations always progress through the following sequence. From bondage to spiritual faith, i.e. our revolution. From spiritual faith to great courage. From courage to liberty. From liberty to abundance. From abundance to complacency. From complacency to apathy. From dependence back into bondage. So, if you think about those steps, where do you think this country is in those steps? Somewhere between complacency to apathy and apathy to dependence, don't you think? And what creates complacency? Lack of false or twisted information. What creates apathy? That same false, twisted information, but one step further, people's inability or their lack of belief, their loss of belief in their ability to change the outcome because they don't believe anything they hear and they don't believe they're being told anything. And of course, with this press, they're right. Yeah. You know, Professor Joseph Olson, he's from Hamline University School of Law. That's in St. Paul, Minnesota. You Minnesotans who are listening to me, I think you probably know the name. He was as fascinated with Tyler's work as I am. I just read you, remember, Tyler, Scottish history professor. I just read you his stuff. But this professor, Olson of the School of Law, he did some interesting statistics. And boy, do they back up what Tyler was saying back there in 1887. Do you know that the number of states won by Obama was only 19 and Romney won 29? You working people? Do you know that the square miles of land won by Obama was approximately 580,000 and Romney's was 2 million? 427,000. Think about that. The population of counties won by Obama was 127 million. Won by Romney was 143 million. The murder rate per 100,000 residents to counties that were won by Obama was 13.2 per thousand. In Romney's, shall we say, constituency, in the areas that voted for him, it was 2.1. Here's what Olson wrote about his chart. Quote, in aggregate, the map of the territory Romney won was mostly the land owned by the taxpaying citizens, the working people, folks, the taxpaying citizens of the country. Obama territory mostly encompassed those citizens living in low-income tenements and living off various forms of government welfare. Ellipsis, unquote. Now think about this. Think about what happens if Congress grants amnesty and citizenship to 20 million illegal aliens. They're also criminal invaders. And then they vote. Think about what will happen then, folks. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Food for thought. Interesting how it all ties together. From a historian in 1887 to an ABC anchor giving unreported money to a candidate that he is covering, to the news that I bring you that you literally can't hear anywhere else despite its critical importance, and how your friends and others vote. And I think you'll come up with a connection of all the dots that I have. We need a press that will stand up and report. A press that won't take no for an answer when a politician, i.e. Hillary, tries to dodge their questions. A press that understands what's important, indeed critical, to the people and therefore informs the people of those matters. And a press who understands the absolute importance of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and aggressively reports on any attack by any person, regardless of ideology, by any attack on those elements of the future. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal once again. I guess I gave you a double goodbye today. We'll talk to you next week, folks. Have a happy and a safe day.